Okay, thanks very much, Phil. That's right, yeah, this talk is about experimental design, and it's not really something that I've ever done until we've actually come to this project here, so it's quite a new area for myself as well. I should say that this work is very much joint, and in particular, a lot of the results that we'll be showing, it's Alex Cook, who's been very much involved in doing this work. Alex is a research associate on a BBSRC-funded project, which is jointly supervised by myself and Chris Gilligan, which is really trying to look at ways of coming up with efficient methods for designing the kind of microcosm experiments and more generally experiments to do with observing development of plant epidemics and other epidemics. So as I say, really trying to use experimental resources as efficiently as we can. So some of the systems that we'll be talking about, you'll actually have seen this morning, Chris has already introduced some of them, and indeed Theo very kindly sort of introduced the idea of Bayesian inference for stochastic epidemic models. So I think probably most of the new stuff, at least for so far as today goes, will be later in the talk when I start talking about the kind of approximations that we can use when we come to tackle experimental design. Because one of the problems with trying to design an experiment is that not only do you have to think about the complexity involved in actually fitting the model when you get the observations, you need to think about the possible ways in which you could observe the system and the possible range of observations that you could get. So there's a lot more sources of complexity which will come into this, and therefore we want to be able to do the computations as efficiently as possible. It's very much work in progress. We're more or less at the end of the first year of this project. So at the moment, we're applying the ideas in the context of the most simple kinds of models which we've looked at. But in subsequent parts of the project, we're going to be looking at trying to apply these ideas in spatial-temporal settings and looking at a much more flexible range of systems. So we'll say a little bit about that in the future work. But the results that we'll actually show today will be very much focused on the kind of microcosm experiments which Chris mentioned earlier today. Okay, so a very quick resume again of epidemics. Nearly all the epidemics or the models that we've looked at fit into this general framework of the SEIR model for an epidemic. Again, we're assuming a closed population, but that's not necessarily an assumption that we'd need to make if it weren't actually appropriate. And for the moment, we're going to assume it's a population that's mixing homogeneously, so any individual in the population is equally likely to be coming into contact at any time with any other. But again, the ideas can actually be applied in the spatial-temporal setting, where obviously mixing is not going to be homogeneous. In the SEIR setting, we can think of the SEIR structure coming from the history of an individual in the population. If you suppose I've got an individual I, then in the SEIR formulation, I'm saying that initially they're going to start off in the susceptible class, so they're not actually carrying the pathogen. Then at some point, they may become exposed. So at that point, we think of them as perhaps actually incubating the pathogen, but not being a source of infection themselves. And at some later point, they may move then into what we call the I class, where they are now actually able to pass on the pathogen to other people in the population. And then finally, they can go into the removed class. This could be due to death, immunity, or literally removal from the population, such as the case of hospitalization, for example, where they're actually taken out. Okay, so when we observe a population generally, we're thinking of a situation in which we might get information on population members at various times throughout the course of an epidemic. That might be done using diagnostic tests of some kind. They could just be simple visual scoring tests in the case of a plant epidemic, or they could be very sophisticated microbiological tests, in which case we might expect them to have different rates, perhaps, of false negative and false positive results. They might not be able to distinguish between different classes here. For example, we may have a diagnostic test which can only distinguish when an individual is actually in the I class. Obviously, the removed class, one probably sees that anyway. So one is unable to distinguish between the S and the E class. And we're also going to have tests which can only be applied with a certain frequency. So the point here is that whenever we actually do observe an epidemic, typically we're expecting we're only going to get a very partial representation of what's going on. Okay, so a stochastic model. Again, this is a fairly sort of general model, and I'll be looking at particular cases of this, or perhaps particular cases with minor modifications to it. But if we're going to write down a stochastic model for this, we would have to be writing down the stochastic rules that govern how individuals go between these classes. So the typical rule that we may use to govern the S to the E transition, so this is really the exposure process, we'll say that if an individual J is in state S at time T, then the probability that it becomes exposed in some small time interval at T is just proportional to the number of individuals in the I class at time T, multiplied by the length of the time interval, and then multiplied by this parameter B here, which I'm thinking then B is going to play the role of the contact rate. So that's the typical sort of exposure process that we use. Another way to think of this, and it's probably worth mentioning this because it's a natural extension that one can make of these kind of models. One way you can think of this is that you can think of each individual in the population as being given a threshold. This is what's known as the Schelke construction for epidemic models. And you can think of these individuals as being given a threshold which is generated independently from an exponential 1 distribution. So they have their threshold, and then as the epidemic proceeds, they sort of clock up infectious challenge. And so what one does is you integrate beta I of t dt, that's the challenge that they're getting, and as soon as they hit their threshold, so as soon as that integral hits the threshold, you become exposed. So that's really essentially saying that the infection or the exposure process is Markovian in the sense that it doesn't matter how long you've been exposed. If you haven't become exposed yet, then that's got no bearing on how much longer you're going to have to wait. One extension of this that one can actually look at is to look at alternative threshold distributions. And I know that Phil, for example, has effectively done that by looking at varying susceptibility with individuals, which is giving you a sort of over-dispersed threshold distribution. So there are ways in which this can actually be generalized as well. So we're not restricted really in this formulation to a Markovian exposure process. But everything I say will really relate to that case. And then we would have to have some model for the amount of time that one spends in the E class. And Theo mentioned gamma distributions, Weibull distributions. In general, then, we're going to have some distribution for that time, which will, again, have some set of parameters, which is going to characterize that distribution. And similarly, we can have a distribution for the amount of time that one spends in the I class. Again, so we'd have a distribution pi parameterized by theta I. And we'll generally assume that the amount of time that individuals spend in these classes is independent between individuals. So we can end up with a model where we have parameters for the exposure process, and we have parameters governing the sojourn time in the E class and also the I class. Some of the models which I'll look at, in fact the main model that we'll look at later, actually has a slightly more complicated exposure process where we have not only infection between individuals, but we have the idea of primary infection. We can think of that as being infection from the environment. So in the models that I'm going to look at, you'll see that there's also a term alpha that comes in here, which is added on to that, and that's an additional source of infection that we'd have, which is not dependent on the number of people in the I class. But the problem is then, how do we estimate the parameters in these kind of models? So likelihood in Bayesian inference in a nutshell, well again we've already had this, but I suppose just to keep the notation consistent in this talk, it's worth going through it. I'm always going to think of Y as being my observations that I have from, I'm assuming that these observations are coming from a model, let's say of the type that I've just described, with some unknown parameter vector theta. Then the likelihood principle really says that all the evidence that we're going to get about theta is going to be contained in the likelihood. So I want to look at this likelihood L of theta given Y, which I can think of informally as being the probability of Y given theta. And then my inference about theta is really going to be determined on how this actually varies with theta. In the Bayesian approach, we take this further because we're not just going to work with likelihoods. We're actually going to turn these likelihoods into probability distributions by weighting the likelihood according to some prior pi of theta, which is going to represent our prior beliefs about theta before collecting the data. So all our inference then about theta is going to come through this object here, the posterior pi of theta given y, which is proportional to my prior pi of theta multiplied by the likelihood. And if I'm particularly interested in, let's say, one single component in theta, often we're interested in things like contact rates and how contact rates might be affected by treatments. Some of the other parameters we have in the model are effectively nuisance parameters. We can always make inference about individual components by looking at the marginal posterior densities. So this is all fairly standard stuff. But when we actually look at epidemics in particular, then we find that all sorts of complications come in associated with this problem of only being able to observe things partially. So again, why is my observed data? And that's going to be incomplete for all sorts of reasons. In this talk, it'll be mainly because we have limited frequency of sampling. So I could think of Z as being a complete representation of the stochastic process which I'm observing. So whenever you see Z, you can think of that as being a complete realization. In the context of an epidemic, what would Z have to contain? It would have to tell you the times and the nature of all the events that had occurred, so all the transitions that had occurred, and it would have to tell you which individuals they'd actually occurred to. So Z would be the complete set of all information about the epidemic. And the problem is that we can write down the likelihood for Z. So if we played God and observed everything that happened, we could write down that likelihood quite easily, and Theo showed the equation for that earlier on today. But the problem is that we only observe Y, so really the likelihood which we want looks like some integral of this likelihood here over the set of all possible Z that are consistent with what we've observed. So to get hold of this likelihood, we would have to try and perform an integral which could be quite nasty. Because if you have X individuals, well, let's say N individuals in your population, and you're not observing the N specific infection times, let's say, then this object Z here, which would have to contain all those N infection times, is living in this big sort of N-dimensional space. So in general, that's not a nice thing to do. But the Bayesian approach has really made problems like this very tractable, which I think is why one can also see, or should see, methods like Markov chain Monte Carlo as, I think, generally having an awful lot to, a big role to play in stochastic integration in general. Because what we're able to do is to say, well, let's look at those hidden aspects of the data. So think of X as being the parts of the realization of the epidemic, which we haven't seen. Let's think of those as being additional unknown parameters. So we're thinking of all these infection times, for example, or exposure times as being unknown parameters. What we can do is we can effectively append those unknown parameters to my existing parameter vector and look at the joint posterior of theta and X given Y. And then we can make inference on theta, again, by looking at the marginal distribution of theta given y. So why does this tend to make things a lot easier? Well, if I write down what this joint posterior looks like by Bayes' theorem, it should look like the product of my, or be proportional to the product of the prior, multiplied by the sampling density at x and y given theta. Now, this second term here is essentially just this likelihood that I would have if I had the full data set. So together, X and Y are making up Z. So this is something which is going to be tractable. So what I've been able to do is I'm able to write down this posterior density as being proportional to some quantity which I'm at least able to investigate analytically. Okay. So this is an actual situation in which we can actually use Markov chain methods, because we're then able to use Markov chain Monte Carlo, and a lot of this is now very standard, I think, but we can actually generate samples from this joint posterior density. So we can generate samples where an individual sample consists of a pair of a parameter theta I and a realization of the missing aspects of the process using standard methods such as Metropolis, Hastings, and Gibbs sampling. And we're able to then to generate a sample from this joint posterior density. So Markov chain Monte Carlo always involves just constructing a Markov chain which has got this as its desired stationary distribution. And a lot of the, even though it's easy to write this down in theory, a lot of the actual hands-on work is involved in actually trying to come up with a chain which has got the right stationary distribution and mixes sufficiently efficiently so that one is able to generate a sufficiently large sample from that distribution. In practice, and I'm not going to say very much at all about the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, because these can easily be found in a range of references, just to say that what it normally involves you having to do is obviously propose and accept or reject changes not only to the parameter vector, but also to the realization of the missing data, if you like, to get your new state vector. And it's often in doing the updates to this part of the parameter vector that a lot of the difficulty comes in. One often finds that one is able to update some of the components of the parameter vector using Gibbs steps, where we can draw directly from conditional distributions, but in actually doing things like coming up with realizations of missing infection times, and in my experience anyway, that's where a lot of the work has had to go into. And we have to use often Metropolis-Hastings methods, and obviously reversible jump time methods come in here, because if one is ignorant about precisely how many missing infection times there are, for example, if you haven't seen the end of the epidemic, so there could still be infectives out there that you haven't spotted, then this realization of missing data is living on some space that has components of different dimensions depending on how many missing infections there are. So one has to be able to jump between these components using the reversible jump methods. But as I say, there are a lot of references out there, not only the ones I've listed. I know that Elia Arjas, I think I remember, you've also used these kind of methods looking at the streptococcal infection, and also they've been applied out with the epidemiological scenario. So just an example of this, I'm going to analyze this famous Rhizoctonia epidemic of 1995, I think it was, that Chris maybe put up a similar sort of slide to this. 1895, yes, which was deliberately started by a researcher in the laboratory, I think. But just to illustrate, okay, these kind of methods in practice, and Chris did mention this morning, what we have here are 10 epidemics of Rhizoctonia in radish. So this is a fungal pathogen, which effectively, Chris showed the pictures, effectively makes the plants shrivel up and fall over fairly rapidly. And there's, say, 5 replicates of 2 treatments. In one treatment, the antagonistic fungus Trichoderma is added, and in the other treatment, Trichoderma isn't added. And these replicate populations with 50 individuals in each were opened up, and the infected individuals were identified on a sequence of observation times. And you can see that this data set has been very frequently sampled, and I think Chris mentioned the amount of work that goes into this, having to take out each of these replicates and individually score each plant to see whether or not it's infected or not. So this is an example of the kind of data then which one could actually investigate using the kind of methods that I've described. And the kind of questions that we'd be particularly interested in is first of all saying, well, does there seem to be any effect of the Trichoderma on the system? And if there is an effect, what aspects of the system are being affected by the Trichoderma? So a simple model that one could actually apply to look at this, and it's a slight development of the model which I just described. It's really what we would call an SEI model. So there's no removed class here, that the plants are not taken out of the population. An SEI model with primary and secondary infection, and also this quenching term, which I'll mention in a moment. The quenching term is really just a way of trying to represent the fact that as the plants grow, they become more robust, they become less susceptible, therefore, to colonize it or attack by the Rhizoctonia fungus. And so it's just a way of trying to build that into the model. But the particular model that we look at then, for any susceptible individual at time t, the rate at which it's going to get exposed at that time just looks like the following. We've got a term which I'll call RP, which is my primary infection term. So that's really representing the initial inoculum in the soil. Then there's RS times the number of infected. So this really is what we'll call the secondary infection. And then we have this X to the minus AT, which is representing the decline in the susceptibility of individuals as the epidemic continues. We have an exposed class here. And I'm going to assume that the time spent in the exposed class is fixed, so it's a fixed time for each individual. It's the same for each individual, but unknown. So mu could actually, that's going to be another unknown parameter, so that at some time mu after the exposure, an individual then becomes infected. Okay, so using vague priors for the parameters, independent priors as well, the kind of posteriors then which we get for these, and here I'm just plotting the marginal posteriors for these four parameters which we have, what we find is that when we compare the marginal posteriors for the secondary quenching term and also this latent period mu, obviously they're not the same, but there doesn't seem to be particularly strong evidence that there's a big difference in those parameters. But there does seem to be evidence that between the two treatments, there's a difference in the primary infection parameter. So one might tentatively suggest then that the rhizoctonia may be affecting this system by interfering by the primary infection process rather than the secondary infection process. Those results are actually robust in the qualitative sense that if one takes a whole lot of other alternatives for this model, so for example, if we assume that the observations don't relate to the I class, but they also relate to the E class as well. So in other words, we see plants as soon as they're exposed, but they may not yet be infective. It affects quantitatively the parameter estimates that we would get, but it doesn't affect the qualitative conclusion that the difference between the two treatments is in the primary infection term. Similarly, if you dispense with the exposed class, and it's not inconceivable that mu is equal to zero here. So if we looked at the simple SI model with quenching, again, we find exactly the same qualitative conclusion coming out, although it does affect the actual quantitative rates. So this does seem, at least qualitatively, to be quite a robust conclusion. And this is sort of typical of the kind of examples that one might find in the literature. And I suppose, you know, I'm certainly as guilty as anybody in this respect. I think as statisticians, particularly when we're looking at new models and looking at how we would actually fit those models to data sets, I think we often concentrate on trying to do things in a very sort of statistically sound way within really respecting the likelihood principle and taking into account the fact that we only have partial observations. And perhaps we focus on historical data sets that we can use to test out these methods. And certainly there's a number of data sets now, and I would say the rhizoctonia data has been pretty well flogged to death, but various other epidemics that I think many of us have probably looked at, with smallpox in Africa and things, you know, where we look at these historical epidemics, but maybe we could also be more prospective and say, well, what can we say about the way in which we should go out to collect future data in order to get the most amount of information out of it? And this is really what the question of experimental design is about. It's really not only requiring us to address the uncertainty which we have in the data that we've got, but really need to think about the uncertainty in the future realizations of these processes if we're going to go and do subsequent experiments on them, and also the possible range of ways in which we could actually look at these experiments. And just going back to the rhizoctonia. For example, I think Chris mentioned earlier on this morning that you know, this had been very heavily sampled, an awful lot of work. A natural question would be to say that if one was going to deploy a lot less in the way of manpower to do the sampling, what would be the appropriate way to do it? What's the optimal way to use the resources? So if we weren't going to look at it quite so often as this, and then when would be the appropriate time to look at it. One thing I should say, of course, is that without having a data set like this to start with, there's all sorts of things which one wouldn't have been able to do, and questions such as testing the goodness of fit of a model, for example. A data set like this is absolutely is invaluable for that. And one of the reasons I think we can have at least some confidence in the models that we've looked at for this is because the original data sets were so richly sampled. Okay, well, experimental design is something that can be done within the the Bayesian framework, and the approach that we're taking, it can really be found in a paper by Peter Muller and his co-workers, and I think this is a paper from Valencia in 1999. And it really takes the experimental design problem and puts it in the Bayesian framework quite nicely. At least in theory, it can be put in the Bayesian framework, but with any approach like this, it's going to be feasible to different extents, depending on the application. But what's the idea behind the Bayesian framework? Well, again, we're assuming that we're going to be observing observations that come from some stochastic model, which has parameter vector theta, and we have a prior belief about theta, which is represented by pi of theta. And now I'm going to have to think about the future realizations of the stochastic process. So if I carry out experiments on this system, what are these future realizations going to look at? So Z dash is going to be a future realization, and with a slight abusive notation here, I'm going to think of the sampling density as being pi of Z dash given theta. So this is going to be the distribution for essentially the complete outcome of whichever system I'm looking at. So in the context of an epidemic, Z dash is going to contain all the information about infection times, exposure times, and sojourn times, and so forth. Okay, when I carry out an experiment, I'm not going to be able to observe Z dashed. I'm going to have to use some particular design D. Now, I'm using D very generally here. What do I mean by a design? Well, it could mean specifying the particular sampling times. It could mean specifying the kinds of diagnostic tests. It could mean, in a spatiotemporal system, where do I actually locate the individuals? So D is just all the things which I'm actually able to choose in taking those observations. So what I'll actually get then will be some kind of censored or filtered version of Z dash, which essentially this just means, what do I observe when I take this design D and observe this complete realization Z dash? So D of Z dashed might, for example, tell me the number of infected individuals at a number of specific times. Okay, so it's some function of Z dashed. Okay, the other thing I would then need to do is I'd have to have some measure for how useful this experiment was going to be. So I would want to be able to come up with some utility function, and although I'm not really taking a decision theoretic approach here, I'll use the term utility function since it's used also in Muller's work. But this is going to quantify the amount of information that I get from observing Z dash using the design D. And it might also, in other examples, you might try to build in the actual cost of the experiment in this function as well, so some cost associated with D. And the whole idea then of coming up with a good experimental design would be to select D so that it optimizes some aspect of the distribution of this utility. And here I'm going to look at the case where we actually look at maximizing the expectation of the utility function. So can I choose a design which is going to give me, on average, the greatest amount of utility according to my definition of utility? So how does this sort of fit into this framework which I've already described? And the kind of Bayesian trick, if you like, is to treat the design D as an additional variable and assign some joint distribution to pi, z dash, and d. So now we're thinking of the design itself being a random variable. So in the context of a design that was consists of perhaps specifying particular sampling times, then we're thinking of those sampling times as being random variables. And I'm going to define then a joint density on theta, z dash, and d, in such a way that this joint density is proportional to pi of theta, so that's my prior, multiplied by pi of z dash given theta, and then I'm going to bring the design in by having the dependence on the design coming in the form of this utility dz dash. So right away, we need to be looking at utilities where this is a well-behaved thing. We want to be looking at utilities, for example, which are going to be positive if we're going to try and build a density like this. Now, if you integrate this with respect to z dash and also then with respect to theta, what one finds is that the marginal density of the design D would then actually be proportional to this expected utility, the expectation of U of D. So, in a way, what we've done is to identify this problem of getting the design with the optimal utility or optimal expected utility, we've turned it into one of trying to identify the marginal mode of the design. Okay, so if we are somehow able to generate a set of samples now from this joint distribution, theta, z dash, and d, and by looking at that, identify what the marginal mode of d actually was, then this would tell us what the optimal design was in terms of maximizing the expectation of u of d. So that in itself is not always going to be particularly easy, because if you've ever tried to identify the mode of a distribution, particularly if it's a very, very high dimensional distribution from a random sample from the distribution, then it's not necessarily a very easy thing to do. But hopefully, in the example we'll look at here, where we're actually trying to select sampling times, since one would want to be working with a fairly small number of sampling times in order to have an efficient design, one would naturally be looking at situations where the dimension of d wasn't too high. But this essentially then is the approach that we're taking by setting up Markov chains which can investigate this joint distribution here and trying to identify the marginal mode of d. Then we're hopefully going to be coming up with designs which are efficient. So I've said that this looks simple, and I don't really mean it does. I don't think it does look so simple. But what are the kind of difficulties that would naturally then arise here? Well, I've mentioned one about the problem of trying to identify the marginal mode, but there are other difficulties which we're going to come across. And one would be that if you're a Bayesian, and okay, you really do believe that everything you know about theta is going to be embodied in the posterior distribution for theta that you get from your experiment, then in a way you'd like to base your utility on that posterior. We would like to look at some way in which utility is related to the posterior distribution. Now, there's a number of different measures that people have used, and I know that I think Lindley has used Kulbeck-Leibler divergence. We're not wedded to actually using that, but it's one possible way of proceeding here. The Kulbeck-Leibler divergence is one measure of showing how different the prior distribution and the posterior distribution actually are. In general, the Kulbeck-Leibler divergence between any two densities is a way of quantifying how different they are. And what does it actually look like? Well, Kulbeck-Leibler divergence would essentially just look like the integral of the posterior for theta multiplied by the log of pi of theta given y over pi of theta, so the log of the posterior over the prior. And this thing will be zero if the prior and the posterior are the same, otherwise it's always going to be positive. Now, there's a couple of things that, one thing to point out here is that any divergence from the prior would be seen as a good thing. So Kulbeck-Leibler divergence would be large if you perhaps started off with a very, very very informative prior and ended up with a completely non-informative posterior. You see, it would sort of quite like that. It would say that you've really moved on in your belief. You were very sure, and now you've done this experiment, and now you're completely ignorant, and that would be seen as progress. Now, I would say that is a pathological situation, which I think is unlikely to arise in the situation that we're in. But there are reasons why one might want to look at alternatives, and that's why the question mark is really there. But with doing this kind of thing, what's the problem that we've got? Well, the problem is that I've kind of embedded this posterior density actually in this expression here. So I started off by talking and saying that, this is quite a difficult thing to do for epidemics and how we can use MCMC to do this, and we can do this within a reasonably short period of time, just for a single epidemic, but if I'm embedding it in here and now thinking of this as being some quantity which is going to repeatedly be evaluated in some optimization routine, let's say, then the fact that this is difficult to compute is a genuine problem. I can't allow myself to take hours to get hold of this thing here. So that's going to be a difficult problem. And what I want to look at then is how we can use approximations in order to try and make this computation much more tractable. So a kind of cheap and cheerful way of trying to do this. And there are a number of different approaches to doing this. But I'm going to focus on this R. Solani example and try and follow this approach through in this specific case. and in particular then show how techniques such as moment closure, I think, have got quite a role to play here. So this was the academics which were looked at, say, back in 1995, and you can see that they're very frequently sampled. And now I'm going to look at the problem then of trying to identify a suitably minimal set of sampling times that could essentially give us the same information from these experiments. Okay, so we're wanting now to select a sparse set of M observation times for these microcosm experiments. So I'm going to focus on the simpler model where the latent period is assumed to be zero. Now certainly when we, and Chris showed the results this morning, I think, when he plotted the evolution of the replicates with the predictions from the model, and one actually gets a good fit to this when one dispenses with the latent period. So I'm going to look at that case initially. So let's suppose I've got three sampling times, for example. Suppose I've only got the manpower to actually have somebody take this out and look at it on three particular occasions. How would I actually want to go about choosing these times using this approach? Okay, well, in this experiment then, my observations Y would correspond to the number of infections at time T1, and similarly at time T2, and similarly at time T3. My parameter vectors theta has just got three components: the primary infection rate, the secondary infection rate, and the quenching rate. And I'd like to sort of get hold of an approximation then of this utility for this particular case, an approximation which doesn't require me to somehow try and investigate this posterior distribution here. So I want to get a very cheap and cheerful approximation. I'm going to do two approximations here, and any approximation is dodgy, and it's really how well it works in practice, I think, that would determine how useful it would be. So we'll actually show results where we follow this through and see how well it does work. But first approximation is that instead of working with a continuous prior, I'm actually going to take a random sample from that prior and use a uniform distribution on that random sample as my prior distribution. So I'm obviously, the richer or the larger the random sample that I actually take, the better representation of the prior that I would get. And there's some analogy here with particle filtering methods, but this would be one way in which I could. This is essentially to enable me to simplify the calculation of the integration. But the main approximation I'm going to talk about is how we can actually approximate this likelihood, L of theta, using what are called moment closure methods. And I know moment closure methods have been mentioned, and I'll say a little bit more about them just now, because I think this is probably one useful application of them, perhaps. So what's the basic idea here? Well, for this model, we can always write down the likelihood in the following way. We can decompose it in the usual way into some product of terms. We can say that our likelihood L of theta, it's the probability that I of T1 is equal to I1 given theta. I should say that I of 0 is always assumed to be 0 here. We're starting from no infection. Then we have to multiply by the conditional probability that I of t is y2, given that I of t1 was y1 and the parameter theta, and so forth. And we keep multiplying up, and that's where our likelihood is coming from. Now, the idea which we've been following through, and Alex has got to take a lot of credit for this, because I think this was first sort of looked at as an approximation method in, I think, your honours project, so it's been around for a wee while, but we've found an application for it. The idea is to look at each term individually and approximate each of these terms using moment closure. So how does this actually work? Well, that quenching term, without going into details, we can dispense with that effectively from the model, because for this particular model it really just corresponds to a kind of rescaling of time, so I can forget about that for the moment. Let's suppose we've got to time tk. What I'm going to do is consider the subsequent evolution of the epidemic from time tk. So I'm going to let n naught be n minus I of tk, and n naught really then represents the remaining susceptibles I have in the population. C we can write as r of p, rp plus r of s times I of tk. So this is really the infectious pressure on any individual who's susceptible at time tk. So effectively, I can think of this as being a new primary infection rate, which we follow through from time tk. And then j of t is going to be the number of infections that have happened after t key case. So in a way, it's a bit like I'm starting from a new epidemic and all the previous infections are contributing to primary infection, and I've just decreased the size of the susceptible population. Now, in moment closure, what one does is you try to approximate the evolution of the moments of the population variables using a system of differential equations. So if we're going to do that for JT, then we'd have to look at those stochastic increments to JT, so I could write down the model for those increments. Don't worry so much about the details of this, you can work through it, but it's really just a general message here. By taking expectations of these things, I'm able to derive a differential equation for the evolution of the expectation of JT. And you can see that those model parameters are appearing in that, along with the expectation of JT and, unfortunately, the expectation of J squared of T, okay, which is coming from taking the expectation of this term up here. So when I write down this differential equation, unfortunately, I've got the second moment appearing there. So I'd better try and do the same thing for the second moment. But when I go through the same process, so I look to see the increments to the second moment, one comes up with a differential equation. Well, there's the first moment, there's the second moment, that's okay, but oh dear, there's the third moment, and so forth. So if one carried on in this way, every time you plotted an additional differential equation, you'd have another moment of higher order. So how can we get round it? Eric might disagree that this is moment closure. I would say it.
Moment closure.
All right. Well, one way to do it. There's various ways to do it, but one way to do it is to impose a distributional form on the distribution of JT. If you could approximate the distribution of JT at any time by some suitable distribution, then if that was a good approximation, one may be able then to use that to close the system of equations. So what we assume here is, I should say, you know, this is, Alex should get most of the credit for all this bit here, but let's look at JT coming from a beta binomial distribution with parameters N0, alpha, and beta. If you haven't come across a beta binomial distribution, one way to think of it is a mixture distribution where, suppose I first of all generate a value of p from a beta distribution with parameters alpha and beta, and then using that value of p, I generate an observation from a binomial distribution, a binomial N0p, then that gives me a random sample from a beta binomial distribution. So it's a mixture distribution, really a binomial distribution where p itself follows a beta distribution. So it's an over-dispersed version of a binomial distribution, if you like. Okay, so if we did impose that relationship there, then what we would find is that alpha and beta at time t are going to be determined by the first two moments of J of t, so it'll be a one-to-one mapping there. And then I would also have that the third moment of J would be determined by alpha and beta. So therefore, there is some mapping between the first two moments and the third moment, and I can use that mapping then to close the system of equations. So we've looked at these kinds of, I'll just go back, we've looked at these approximations in a number of scenarios, and of course it's only going to be a sensible approach if it gives you a reasonable distribution to the true distribution that one would get from that model. Work with Istri Krishnaraja, Glenn Marion, and also Alex. We used this for the SIS model, and that appeared in Bulletin Mathematical Biology last year. For the particular model that we're interested in here, I hope this slide will maybe give you an indication of how well a beta binomial captures the variability we'd expect from the model. What we've got here is essentially the true distribution indicated by the histograms for the number of infected individuals in the population for this primary-secondary quenching model under two different parameter regimes, more or less corresponding to the situation where there's no trichoderma and where there is trichoderma. And what we're hoping is that our beta binomial probabilities should match up reasonably well with the true model probabilities, where these are, to actually calculate these, you would have to evaluate things like matrix exponentials, which can be fairly sort of time-consuming. So it's going to be a lot quicker to be able to use the moment closure to evaluate these using the beta binomial approximation if this is a reasonable approximation. So what we're finding when you look at this, if you look at the dotted line, you find that by and large there's a good correspondence between the beta binomial distribution and the true population distribution throughout the course of the epidemic over a range of parameter values corresponding to what we're expecting to see. You can see it's breaking down here in the case for the no trichoderma situation, where we have low primary infection. Beta binomial distribution is really underestimating the probability of getting a complete zero epidemic, so the one that doesn't take off at all. But elsewhere, it's not too bad as an approximation. So how we would then actually use that in our likelihood approximation scheme, how would this work in practice? Well, going back to the situation where I've got these observations at three different times, how this would work is that if I observe I of T1, I of T2, I of T3, and I have my parameter vector RP, RS, A, I essentially integrate this pair of ordinary differential equations to approximate the distribution for I of T1 given I0 is equal to 0. And then from that beta binomial approximate distribution, I pull out the appropriate probability corresponding to what I've observed. I then integrate forward again using, as my initial condition, I of T1. I now integrate forward, I get an approximate beta binomial distribution, and I can pull out a probability for that and build it up in that way. And so therefore, in this case, if I've just got three observation times, I can use this to get a very quick estimate of what the likelihood would actually look like given the realization I of T1, I of T2, I of T3. Okay, so how do we then embed this into this algorithm for the experimental design? Okay, so we want to be able to draw from this joint density here where we've got theta, the parameter vector, z dash, the full realization of the epidemic, and d, and it should be proportional to the prior multiplied by pi of z dash given theta and my utility. So d is going to represent my set of n distinct sampling times, and theta is my prior, and I'm using this approximation to the prior by sampling from the original prior and then now assuming that theta is a priori uniform over this finite set of points. Z dashed is the complete process, and that's therefore the complete infection information that I have. I'll just quickly outline the steps of the algorithm because, say, this can all be read about in the paper which Alex has recently submitted on this. We would have to propose new values of theta dashed and z dashed jointly. So I'm going to draw a parameter vector from the prior. For that particular parameter vector, I simulate a realization of the complete epidemic. And then I'm going to accept this pair, theta dashed, z dashed, with some acceptance probability, which is related to the ratio of the utilities. Otherwise, I reject it. So that's really for updating theta dashed and z dashed. When it comes to proposing changes to the design, in this particular example here, since the design consists of a number of discrete observation times, proposing changes to the design is going to correspond to proposing shifts to the actual observation times. And I want to obviously do that in such a way that we're going to explore the set of possible times fairly efficiently. And again, I'm going to be accepting or rejecting these with an acceptance probability, which again now depends on the ratio of the utility for my new design compared to my old design. Okay, so one can see then that whenever a utility calculation comes up in this algorithm, that requires me to use these approximations. So those approximations are going to be frequently used here. Some things to note here. As I've described it, I've really talked about designing an experiment where we're just going to do a single replicate experiment. However, we can also look at optimal designs for multi-replicate experiments. In fact, there's no reason to think that if one's going to do many replicates of look at many replicate epidemics, there's no reason to assume that one should always use the same observation times for each. For example, it might make sense to have half of them that you look at early on and sort of look at some of the others later on. And we have looked at this, and contradict me if I'm wrong, Alex, but by and large it does seem that the optimal design tends to repeat the same design for each one. So, but one can actually, I say, look at these general questions in this framework. Other things that we can do is that we can sharpen the utility. I mean, if you're looking for the mode in this marginal distribution, then if your utility only weakly depends on the design, then that's not going to be very good for actually finding that mode. So one way to actually do that is, instead of proposing and accepting or rejecting a single combination of theta and z, one can actually propose a number of different independent combinations and either accept or reject these jointly. Effectively, what you're now doing is making your marginal distribution of the design proportional to some power of your expected utility, so you're making your marginal distribution look a little bit sharper. But of course, one has to do an awful lot more in the way of proposing and accepting and rejecting, and one might, may end up with a poorly mixing chain, so there are various compromises there. But what I want to do now then is to say, well, if we actually implement this and apply it to the kind of systems that, that Chris is looking at, what sort of designs would one actually come up with? Given that time is, I did say I would talk for less than an hour, and I think I might just manage that if I jump forward here. So let's suppose then that we're going to look at designing experiments where we're going to look at the same system that Chris looked at before, again with populations of size 50. First of all, in the case where we don't have trichoderma added. If I was going to repeat these experiments then with a small number of observation times, where should I actually put them? Okay, well, I would need to have a prior distribution for my parameters, and it makes sense to look at the joint posterior distribution of those parameters from the analysis of that data as a starting point for how I think the system's going to behave the next time I actually come to look at it. So if you like, for the no trichoderma case, these solid curves were the marginal posteriors. I should stress we're not treating these as being a priori independent here. These are the marginals. What we do for our prior is look at the joint posterior of these given this set of data. I'll call that pi dashed. So therefore, using this approximation of just discretizing by taking a random sample from that, we'll take a random sample from that joint prior, look at a uniform distribution on that, and that will give me pi dashed. There's two situations that we'll look at. I mean, we've discussed various, I suppose, philosophical issues in the course of experimental design. And I think something to bear in mind is, you know, the purpose of the experiment and who it is that one is trying to convince. And we've distinguished two particular cases here, what we'll call progressive and the confirmatory or sort of pedagogic design. If one was absolutely certain that the model that you fitted was completely valid and you were completely sure about the validity of the posterior that you'd got, and you really did feel that this did determine how the system was going to look at, so you've got no doubt about what you've done, then it would make sense to design your experiment to maximize the expected information change with respect to pi dash. So that's your prior or your belief regarding the parameter having done the first set of experiments. So in that case, we would use pi dashed to propose our new z's and pi dashed as the prior in the utility calculation. But suppose you were going to recommend to somebody else who was a bit more skeptical about what you'd done, what design they should do. So somebody who thought there was something wrong with your first set of experiments, and therefore they might actually prefer to use your original prior because they felt that somehow you weren't justified in moving on from that, then how would you advise them to do it? Then you would need to take into account the prior that they were going to use in calculating their posterior. So you could think of what we could call confirmatory or pedagogic. It's really saying, how would you repeat the experiment in order to maximize the expected information with respect to your original prior pi? So in other words, effectively going back to your beliefs before the first experiment and repeating it, but trying to do it in a more efficient way. So I think the question of what prior one uses in the utility is really, I think, a question of who it is that one is trying to convince by doing the experiments in the first place. For the set of designs, we're going to constrain these to be a subset of the original sampling times from the first experiment. Okay, now the reason for doing that is that we want to be able to go back and compare what we would have got if we'd used these designs or Chris and his team had used the designs in the first set of experiments. So instead of allowing the t's to vary continuously, the t's are just going to be drawn to be a subset of the original sampling time so we can go back and compare. Okay, in these two situations, what we can then do is use this method to identify the optimal times to observe for a range of different designs. Now, you'll see that, just to try and explain these, you'll see there's a whole lot of dots here. If we look at the black dots, first of all, the bottom row, this black dot is telling me the optimal time, according to this algorithm, if I'm only going to ever observe the system once. Okay, the two dots above it are corresponding to the optimal times if I'm going to take two observation times. And this is for this pedagogic or confirmatory design, where in the utility calculation I'm using the original prior. And something that's quite surprising, I think, is that it does tend to focus on later aspects of the epidemic. It's saying that there's relatively little that one's going to get from the earlier part of the epidemic, and we can discuss reasons why that is actually the case. When we look at the corresponding thing for the progressive designs, again, it's sort of affecting or it's mainly focusing on the later part of the epidemic, and it's actually tending to be slightly later times than one has for the pedagogic times. Now, one reason for this is that of course, we're using this pi dashed. We're assuming that the replicates that we're going to get in our next experiment are coming from a model where the parameters are drawn from our posterior. And that posterior was coming from that first set of experiments which Chris's team had done. And from that, we actually got pretty good information on those primary infection rates. So this is kind of reflecting the fact that we already know a fair bit in our prior about primary infection. If one looked in that posterior at the byplots of secondary infection versus the quenching term, one would see that there's an awful lot of confounding between secondary infection and quenching. And what these designs are perhaps reflecting is that if you want to move on from your current position, the best thing to do is to try and sort out this ambiguity between quenching, so decreasing susceptibility, and high or low secondary infection. So it's perhaps really trying to resolve that particular issue in coming up with this design. But there is, a slight difference in the designs that it's suggesting for the two cases of pedagogic and progressive. And these are obviously constrained, as I've said. The reason that they're coming out as integers is because they're constrained to match to be a subset of the original sampling times. But what I think is interesting also is if we say, well, had we used some of these designs in this original experiment, what information would we have got? Well, in terms of estimates of the parameters, we wouldn't have got an awful lot less. These are the marginal densities that we got from the original full data set, and for each parameter, you can see that it's not so clear with the two. That's not very good. This is for primary infection. But for three and four observation times, one's actually picking up a lot of the primary infection, a lot of the information on primary infection there. Similarly, for secondary infection, again, for two or three observation times, one's getting a lot of information on the secondary infection, and similarly on the quenching. So we do actually pick up a lot of information on the parameters, even with these much more efficient designs. However, the thing that you definitely don't get from doing this is the information on how well it fits. Of course, this is all predicated on this being the correct model, and we could only have been sure that this was a reasonably good model to actually look at if we'd done all this sampling, or if Chris's team had done all this sampling in the first place. So even though this seems to be, it's looking at a very specific aspect of the design, if you're interested in being able to choose between models, then that's a different design problem. I think there's a nice analogy with linear regression, that if you wanted to design an experiment to maximize your estimate of a slope parameter, then it would tell you to put half your x values at one end of the range and the other half at the other end of the range. But effectively, you'd only end up with two values of x, so you would never be able to test whether or not a straight line was a good model, although you'd have a great estimate of its slope. So anything to do with model choice, really has to be taken into account here as well. We're not looking at model choice here, and if that was part of the design problem, then a different approach would be taken. But what I've tried to do there is give an indication. Actually, sorry, I should have not just about to finish off here. There's a quicker way of doing this. Further work, obviously we want to look at designs for imperfect diagnostic tests. I mean, we're assuming that our diagnostic tests are accurate here, but for many diseases, there's going to be a false negatives, false false positives. I think in particular spatiotemporal modeling, which is, we're already starting to look at this in another project with a PhD student, and Alex is looking at this as well, where now designs would also include things like location of where the hosts are and the inoculum are. I was looking at, that was a Markovian system we've looked at there, generalizing this to non-Markovian systems where the moment closure may not be expected to work quite so well. And I think in all of these things, somehow getting efficient approximations of likelihoods is going to be the key, because a lot of this really relates to how quickly one can estimate likelihoods and embed them in this rather more complex problem. So I'll stop there and take questions.
Okay, thank you, Anna. Okay, questions?
In some cases, you may have some clinical data set where you have no information, but you have banked samples, and you want to run, say, a very expensive diagnostic test on a subset of those. So there you have a different situation than you have in these lab studies. Firstly, you're starting off with no information about what you're looking at. Secondly, the times and perhaps the number of samples per replica you have are going to be different. Do you have any ideas about how you would come up with these sorts of adaptive designs to sort of home in on the best design, like doing batches of tests? And also, what kind of samplers might one use when you don't have things lined up nicely in your original data set?
I think the problem of having no information, I think that is really a major in some sense. If you if you're trying to do this with very vague priors, and indeed when we try to do this, I mean your sampling times can really be all over the place, and I would say it's not sensible to try to do this. So it's really what comes first, the chicken or the egg. I mean, in a way, I think one has to use one's best judgment maybe initially, and then perhaps try and get some information before one would be able to follow this through. So I think if you're totally ignorant about parameters in the model, I mean, I think that would be a very, very difficult problem. But some of these other questions, I'm not sure if it's quite what you're saying, but I know that it's the sort of thing that Tim Gottfold has asked about, different possibilities for sampling, say, diseases in orchards where, it can be quite expensive to do all the sort of virological tests. So could you, for example, take samples from four adjacent trees and test that all together and just get an indication of whether or not the disease is here without knowing exactly where it is? I think some of these kind of questions could be looked at if one had some prior knowledge about the dynamics of the underlying stochastic process. So I think you would need to know something about the likely sort of spatial scales and the temporal scales. So I think some of these problems could be built in to this, but I think the one of being sort of ignorant about what's there in the first place, I think that's a, in some sense, that's not a, it's not just a statistical problem. I mean, it's a, I think that's where biological intuition and that are going to be very important.
One thing that worries me about this is you're saying, yes, this would be the optimal design. But of course, real life gets in the way, and you never quite do that. So is it possible to try and find not just the optimal design, but a sort of read of the design space, that if you sample from around there, you're fairly close, so that if somebody cut on half your samples, as actually happened to me once, then you don't need to worry too much about it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the term optimal, I think maybe sensible might be a better, optimal in terms of some criterion, but is that criterion itself sensible? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, since one's generating designs coming from this distribution, you're also getting an idea of how variable how variable that expected utility is going to be. And you're right that you'll find that there's quite a lot of designs which you could perturb these optimal designs and you wouldn't essentially make any great difference. So in a way, it's giving you a ballpark indication where we should put it. But I think it sounds like you're talking about something slightly different in that you're saying, well, there are other things that might go wrong the observation.
I mean, it's the same thing. It's just that around that optimal design, you want to perturb it and see how sensitive it is.
Yeah.
Or whether you can formalize that.
You could do that by looking at more than just the mode of the distribution. You can see how crucial it is. And Alex can perhaps correct me if I'm wrong here, but quite often you find that a lot of designs give you something that's quite reasonable. In a way, this tells you how to avoid the really daft ones, saying that you're not going to get much information by looking here.
What I see is one of the key messages is that very few observations are actually giving you almost as much information as sort of the if you were to change firm and have the design of the optimal time to change it every bit, then you probably still get a fairly good amount of information out of what it is.
I might be missing the point here because it's been some while since I looked at Peter Muller's paper, but he doesn't use that particular kind of utility function.
No.
And a lot of your technical difficulties appear to follow from your choice. So, apart from the fact you wanted to show off in the second half of your talk,
I would say the technical difficulties come from the fact that you want to have a utility that's based on the posterior. Okay.
What did he do?
I'm trying to remember. He sort of introduced it in general without necessarily saying what the utility is. I mean, people have used other utilities which are sort of based on this, which say, for example, assume that you know the true value of the parameter that you've sampled. But other people might want to use, say, a square loss utility. I think that would be a natural thing to look at. So you would therefore have to be able to deal with the posterior distribution. Or, you might want to look at posterior variance. So I think if you're looking at anything which is looking at the properties of the posterior or indeed the properties of the likelihood, so, something like Fisher information, you would still want to be able to get hold of that likelihood. Now, you might say, well, you don't need to integrate it. You could dispense with the integration step. But in a way, I don't think that was the major difficulty. It's trying to get hold of the likelihood itself.
Right. Your loss appears to be measuring different distance from the prior.
Yeah.
For the reasons you explained, so it's completely weird. Closeness to the ideal posterior with an infinite amount of sampling would be one sensible criterion in my mind. And you have that here. Mm. Or, of course, closeness to the true values.
Yeah. So you could... So you could have a utility which takes the Z, right, and looks at the posterior that one would get from the Z, and then looks at the posterior that you get from the Y, and tries to minimize that distance. Okay, so maybe the utility is the reciprocal. But yeah, I mean, that's why I put a question mark in there. I mean, in a way, I'm trying to, we've worked on the framework and realized that there's different bits, different modules that can be slotted in here. And I agree. Kullback-Leibler is one possible measure, which could, as you say, be weird. Although I think that is unlikely that one would get that. I mean, you could say that if you have a reasonably large number of replicates, then the fact that your posterior should be looking asymptotically more normal about the true value, it suggests that the deviation between the prior and the posterior is going to be in the direction that you want. But it's maybe not quite so weird.
Since you mentioned moment closure, possibly I'm allowed to ask a question on it. You've got your beta binomial, which I think is probably optimal. My gut feeling is it is. But Sujan Wang at A&M noted some time back, you probably know, that depending on what order of cumulant closure you closed at, depended on whether you maintained the support of the system. And Colin Gillespie and myself I've done something recently, which, if you're interested, I can move across to you, whereby you could use more sophisticated ways of moment closure. Sometimes it's best to stop at second-order cumulants, sometimes third, sometimes fourth. You never know. So I don't know whether that would be worthwhile, but if it did show that your beta binomial was fairly robust, then I'd be quite confident in maintaining it.
But I just have this little nagging doubt at the back of my mind, what happens if it doesn't? Because sometimes if you do moment closure wrongly, you can lose the extreme tails, and that could be a problem.
I suppose we've maybe looked at that in the paper with ISTRI, where we're looking at SIS models, and you know, it's one of the features of epidemics that one can get extinction as well. So one can have a distribution for the say I of T, which actually has a big spike at zero, and it has a part miles away. And if you're trying to capture that, I think with a cumulant truncation approach, then that sort of phenomenon, I think, is going to be reflected in really, really high-order cumulants.
Probably couldn't even do it, quite honestly.
So the way that we'd sort of taken the beta binomial forward was to sort of embed it in sort of mixture.
I suspect it is optimal, but I'm just mildly curious as to whether...
Yeah. I mean, say there's ways you could generalize it, which might tailor it more to what you would get in epidemics.
You're interested anyway.
Yeah, I mean... It'd be,
the question I had is how would your conditions change if you didn't have these five replicates?
How would they change?
You're looking at to see how many times you should sample. And if you just had one or two.
Oh, I see, right. So, if we.
So in other words, it's part of the reason for the fact that you say we only need to do it three times is because it was done five times in the first place.
These times were specific. The five times it was done in the first place contribute to what you know about the parameters. So if it had only been done twice in the first place, then the priors that we would have had to do the experimental design would be much vaguer, and I suspect that it would have been much harder to do. So yeah, we are exploiting what we have. As regards whether the actual design would change if you're only going to do it two replicates, I think it probably wouldn't. Your optimal.
Kevin again for a very interesting.